Hello and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. It's getting awfully close to the US election, and I thought it might be a good time to talk about it, especially what, you know, a victory for former President Donald Trump might look like for South Africa. I know the American polls are close, but my gut tells me that's better news for Trump than it is for Vice President Kamala Harris, his opponent. The second Trump presidency is just a scary prospect. The world is in enough turmoil as it is, but this guy is much angrier and much darker now than he was when he first ran in 2016. And if anything, he's more unhinged. Not long ago, he stopped speaking at a rally for 39 minutes, more than half an hour, while the sound system played Ave Maria. More recently, I heard him tell the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg that he'd put tariffs of up to 2,000% on imports of Chinese cars. Now, I know a lot of people say, oh, well, it's just Trump, he doesn't really mean it, but literally, anything could happen if he gets back into office, and God help America if he doesn't, because I doubt he would take losing to Kamala Harris if it came to that without a real fight. Could get ugly. Anyway, I've asked Donald Mackay, the CEO of XA Global Trade Advisors, to come onto the podcast and help me think through what particularly the trade and investment implications for South Africa might be if Trump does win. We'll talk about all the other implications too, and I'm going to ask him how he thinks the government of national unity here in South Africa is settling in. But Donald, thanks for being here. And am I wrong to be worried about a Trump victory? Are you worried? Should we all be? Or is it just a scare story and it's 4 years of a bit of turmoil and then he'll go away and everything will come back to normal again?
Woof, that's a tough question, Peter. No, but I am quite worried. And more than that, I'm pretty sure Trump will win. And
yeah, me too.
I think Trump, too, is far, far more dangerous than he ever was the first time around. He knows the ropes, and his policies, if anything, feel even more unhinged than they were the first time around. So I see nothing good happening for any of the countries around the world if Trump wins. But I suspect quite soon we'll find out he has.
And so, I mean, where are we, particularly South Africa, where are we vulnerable to American policy, to Trump?
Well, the US is an enormous trading partner of ours, accounting for somewhere around 10% of all of our trade. It's a big, big deal. And of course, we have programs like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which gives preferential access into the US. I've got to think that is at big risk if Trump wins. But we also have programs like PEPFAR, which of course is a donor program to help with things like HIV. So I've got to think all of these, just in the short term, are potentially at risk. But I think broader than that, if Trump carries out what he has been threatening to do, and I fear he might actually, and begin just imposing duties on everything entering the US, which is kind of what he has said. So depending which day you hear him on, he said, I'm going to impose 60% on everything out of China. I'm going to impose 20% on everything else out of the rest of the world. If that were to happen, it would be absolutely catastrophic. So that would be hundreds of billions of rands worth of trade into a market which suddenly became quite unappealing to export to. And I'm not sure where all of those products would go.
But surely it's not possible for one person to ban all American trade, or to make it all that difficult so quickly. So if he was going, his big targets, right, would be China and the EU's, he goes on a lot about. And of course, his neighbors, Canada and Mexico, get a lot of stick in his speeches as well. I mean, let's assume we weigh down on the pecking order of the things that irritate him, and South African citrus and the odd car and a little bit of steel if we can squeeze some in. If worse comes to worse, and he gets his own way without any checks and balances. I understand, but realistically, we must be way down the list of the things that keep him awake at night.
Yeah, I would think so. So I, you know, I would hope that he just sort of forgets to peer down to the bottom of the map and notice South Africa. But in the event that he does, I think it doesn't end well. South Africa is hardly shy and quiet. So we tend to be all over and in the Americans' faces. So I think we're quite hard to ignore. And I think this is the one person we'd prefer to be ignored by. So I'm not quite as optimistic. I hope you're right, but I fear that you may not be.
You know, I think Trump in his first term once called Africa a shithole or shithole countries. And you may well think that, but equally, you know, people who think that they're superior can often be quite patronizing. And while he's destroying China and the EU, he might nonetheless be nice to Africa. You know, conservatives, it's an interesting thing. I mean, conservatives are often better with African policy than sort of progressive, the more liberal types. Margaret Thatcher got Zimbabwe its independence, and it was George Bush who was talking about PEPFAR, the HIV/AIDS program. Just now, it was a Bush, you know, there was a Republican program, and it's been incredibly successful. Is there a chance that he might, you know, Donald Trump only follows one non-American on Twitter. Can you guess who it is? It's a South African, and his name is...
It's got to be that South African from Pretoria.
No, it's Gary Player.
Oh my God, I thought you were going to say Elon Musk.
No. No, he follows Gary Player. Look, he's not on Twitter a lot. Well, I'm not sure that Gary Player is, but he's Gary Player is the only foreign name on Donald Trump's Twitter account in the other people he follows. And you know, if you were to suggest if there were any trouble, what you could get if Cyril Ramaphosa were to ask Gary to go and play nine holes with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, it could change the world. You know, we might become a favored nation or something like that, despite our growing links with enemies of enemies or Trump regards to be enemies like China. There isn't really any way that you can protect yourself here other than to wait and see and try to be smart when the bullets come your way, I presume.
Well, I don't think there is much we can do except perhaps ask Gary Player to make sure he plays particularly poorly on that day when he does play with Trump so that Trump can give him a good thrashing and feel good about himself.
Yes.
Yeah. But aside from that... No, there isn't a lot we can do. I mean, the elections will yield what they will yield. But at the same time, you know, if we kind of assume Trump at the extreme is quite scary, we shouldn't assume that Harris or even a kind of more moderate Trump is particularly good. Both of them have very strong protectionist leanings. We're kind of moving globally into an era of perhaps not deglobalization, but maybe reglobalization as countries try to figure out who their friends and enemies are in slightly more stark terms. You know, in the old days, the saying was that two countries were the McDonald's and you kind of would never go to war. Russia proved us wrong on that front. But the idea that trade and investment kind of disincentivized conflict, but we've got a very active shift away from that kind of thinking into a more insular kind of autarkic state. And I think that brings with it risks beyond just the obvious short-term economic costs.
Has that shift taken you by surprise? I mean, has it taken the sort of liberal, the liberal intellect globally by surprise? The speed with which the world has realigned itself as being quite amazing.
Yeah, I think we kind of had the perfect storm with Trump in the US, with Trump in the US and Xi in China. You know, truly just a terrible combination. You know, both of them with very strong nationalist leanings. Mm. And, you know, both of them quite belligerent. So I've got to think, when your two largest economies in the world both kind of do the crazy stuff, that's probably not good, but also relatively unusual. So, yeah, I am very surprised. I did not anticipate anything like we saw. But now that I am anticipating, that feels even worse, to be honest.
Yeah. So let's talk about the wide implications. And as I say, its big targets are probably going to be China and the EU. Start with China. Start with Xi Jinping. You know, the Chinese now, their property market collapses. So there's a sort of a bit of a recession at home. People aren't spending money. The Chinese then respond to that by upping exports and driving their production into other markets, flooding the world with things like electric cars. The Europeans are completely terrified. And VW is now talking about shutting down three huge car plants in Germany. If Trump squeezes, first of all, can he squeeze the Chinese? And if he does squeeze them, where do they go? Because the Europeans can't take much more of what they're getting either.
The US has done quite a lot to decouple from China over the last kind of decade or so. So certainly the dependency from a trade perspective is not as great as it was before. But that's not the only connections. You also have a tremendous amount of capital that flows between the two. So if you think about it, the US kind of runs at a perpetual trade deficit. China runs at a perpetual surplus. And China, to a lesser degree now, but still is a substantial funder of that deficit. So, you know, China's a big lender to the US. So that also comes with a set of problems. You can't simply decouple what happens to all of that money. And, you know, I don't think it's possible legally, certainly from a US perspective, to simply say, look, we're going to pull in Argentina and not, you know, kind of not pay the debt. So I don't see any kind of prospect of that, which means I think there are limits to how far the two countries can practically pull apart. But that can still be really far apart. I think an awful lot of damage can be done. The kind of added problem to all of this is that China has a lot of people in the country, but relatively small consumption per person, which means that when China needs to kind of crank up its growth, it's all export focused. You know, so it's already massively overinvested in things like infrastructure. And, you know, so what else do you do with the money except to push it into try to keep your factories productive? So that's, you know, it comes to a different set of issues, such as these electric vehicles, you know, just arriving in Europe or the US or wherever the case might be. Now, it's interesting because the Chinese were looking at, and I forget which Chinese company it was looking to set up a very large car factory in Mexico. And Trump went off on a rant saying that if this was to happen, he'd set a 2,000, I think, percent duty on, cars in Mexico. Completely nuts. And now it looks as if the for now at least, the idea has been shelved until they see what the outcome of the election is. But this is completely crazy. I mean, you might recall in his first term, you know, threatening Macron in France because he felt France was being too protectionist and threatened to impose all kinds of duties on products out of France if they didn't allow US product in. You know, this has kind of got a very 19th century feel to it.
No, absolutely. No, it's very, I mean, so I mean, in the 19th century, these things ended with real war or were they resolved? I mean, were people able to do deals despite very heated feelings
I mean, this is where literally the term gunboat diplomacy comes from.
Yeah.
People would arrive with their ships and their soldiers. So I am quite worried. And I mean, of course, the whole of this century is already feeling quite 19th century with Putin on his kind of imperial excursion to take over Ukraine. So it does feel like we're living sort of two centuries in the past at the moment.
Now, Donald, just bring it back a little bit to South Africa. I mean, so if Trump squeezes the Chinese and they're still producing all these electric cars, right? Because nobody in China is buying them anymore. They can't sell in America. Do they try? What do they do here? Do they end up dumping cars in South Africa or Africa, or are there more lucrative markets to go dump their stuff in, like Asia or South America?
Well, the volume of electric cars being produced in China is so large that I suspect they will arrive anywhere. I wrote a piece about this a few months ago, saying that we should, you know, if we're trying to get electric cars off the ground in South Africa, this may be the perfect opportunity to have lots of them on our roads and you know, drive up consumption of these cars at good prices. The benefit of a trade war between the US and China on electric cars is everyone not in the trade war is going to get electric cars very cheap indeed, I would expect.
Okay.
So perhaps I doubt that's going to land well, but that's certainly an option for us.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then, okay, I want to come back to that point, but I just want to stick with the consequences for the Chinese and the Europeans. What about the Europeans? I mean, a trade war with the US would impoverish Europe. America is just that much more a successful economy. It's growing. They're not growing. It's just much richer. But Europe's a big export market for us too, isn't it? I mean, we need that market, and a Europe in recession isn't going to be good for us either.
No. So, I think one of the things we must realize, if Trump does even a fraction of what he's promising, it's very hard not to see the world going back into another recession. So I think the problem gets a lot bigger than just the countries like Europe. I mean, if Europe gets severely squeezed, there's simply less money to go around to buy our stuff. So it becomes problematic, I think, for the globe, not just for the countries kind of at trade war with each other. What you're going to do is you're going to stifle moving anything around the world. And so I've got to think that can't be good. I'm not sure the world has ever seen anything like this, certainly in the last kind of 150 years. So it feels just like all bad with very little upside. And perhaps ironically, Peter, it's not clear to me how America wins out of all of this.
Well, he would argue that America wins because all these companies are now going to come scurrying back and build what they build in America and not in China because the market is America, and it doesn't matter what the rest of the world is doing. America is energy independent, doesn't need anybody's oil, it's got its own. They're a closed circle. They can survive without us.
They're also close to full employment. So if we were to put all of these duties up, and even assuming people did rush in and put in factories, and that's not clear to me at all that would happen, you're going to find that who's going to work in the factories. We must remember all of this comes coupled with quite a xenophobic view on foreigners in the country. So I'm also curious about how that particular problem gets solved. You know, already there's tension developing with Taiwan. Taiwan is saying the CHIPS Act, which is the big kind of subsidy program for semiconductor production in the US, is sucking so much money out of the system that it's drawing engineers out of Taiwan into the US. So it's placing their whole industry at risk. Because the US is paying huge amounts of money out to these companies. And of course, those skills are not present.
Trump would approve, I presume.
Well, yes, he would. But you know, Trump doesn't strike me as a terribly deep thinker on any of these things. So, you know, I'm guessing he would just simply see this as a net good. But of course, all of this places Taiwan's security at risk. Something else I would guess Trump would be not terribly concerned about, but which does worry me quite a bit. I don't think it would be a good idea if Xi invaded Taiwan. And I think if he believes that Trump is doing things which perhaps inadvertently, but nevertheless weakens Taiwan, I've got to think that starts to become a far more attractive option.
And what's the consequence for you and me down here of Taiwan being part of China and not being an independent country?
Well, quite a few things. Firstly, I think that's a particularly bloody war, as all invasions across water tend to be. So I'm guessing a huge number of people die. But that's also the Taiwan Straits, where so much of the world shipping goes through, be massively disrupted. So if you just consider for a moment the implications of the Houthis shooting their rockets at the ships,
in the
just
Red
imagine
Sea.
That kind of risk. It would be something absolutely horrific, would be my thought.
Yeah. So I mean, Donald, trade obviously is a sort of, it's like blood in our bodies. It doesn't have to. What did globalization sort of supercharged trade, didn't it? I mean, but did it mess it up to the extent that it became possible then, as happened with big American companies, European companies, simply looking around for cheaper places to make their stuff in, than at home, where they had to pay unions and God knows what living wages, and you know, did somebody mess up here? I mean, was the Western industrial elite wrong to pursue low cost as possible manufacturing to the extent that it did? Because it seems to me now that's what's happening, is that it's coming back to bite it. You know, and countries that these big companies left, the voters in those countries are now, you know, starting to vote for slightly mad, scary people like Trump, who promise them the world. They probably can't deliver the world, but you know, by the time you're desperate and out of a job, and you've got kids to feed, you'll believe anybody. Did we make a mistake? I mean, did capital make a mistake?
Well, I think we just maybe separate this into two kind of parts to the question. The one is we have a huge chunk of the world that is lifted out of abject poverty. I mean, China being the biggest winner, but certainly not the only one. Somewhere in the order of 200 million people are moved into the world's kind of biggest middle class. So that's certainly not a bad thing. Does it come at a cost? Yes, of course it does. And you can't just kind of analyze this on a spreadsheet. But I think from that perspective, the world is certainly a lot better off if we have far fewer poorer people. But I think the bigger challenge is how this is distributed. So, you know, the issue of inequality, which is spoken of always in South Africa, I think this is the bigger problem. I think there's a perception that a lot of this wasn't fair, and it wasn't. The U.S. has a tendency to behave quite poorly globally, using its economic muscle to bully people. I think the winners won so much and shared so little that there probably is a perception, quite rightly so, that the inequality just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, yes, many of these countries got wealthier. And even many of the people in the middle of the countries got wealthier, but the wealthy people got so crazy wealthy that I think the difference is stark. I've got to think that's a big part of it. It doesn't feel fair, and I think in many ways it isn't fair. I think, you know, it's hard to look at the system and say, does everyone have an equal chance? My feeling is probably no, they don't.
So do we have is this an opportunity to try again and get it right this time? I mean, what would you do differently? What does the world do differently? What do sensible people do differently?
Well, I have absolutely no idea, to be clear, but I'm happy to try to make it up as we go along. I guess we're living in a world where it is competitive. When the borders begin coming down, you are trading globally, and the nature of that competition is there are winners and losers, and there are a small number of winners who make a huge amount, and there are a large number of losers or companies who just kind of do okay it doesn't really make much of a difference. I think perhaps the West particularly and the developed world have had such a kind of parochial attitude to the rest of the world that that is problematic. You know, if we have a look at the, you know, even the US with a Goa, we're going to have a Goa. It's wonderful. We're going to let all of these African products in. But in reality, the products under a Goa, if you take the whole of Africa, all of the products under a Goa come to less than 0.5% of the US's imports.
Yeah.
So it's not meaningful. And all of the products which actually compete with core industries in the US are blocked. So you have the perception of a benefit which isn't really one. We'll see the hysteria in the media over what happens if we lose a Goa. But let me quantify that for you. The value, the rand value of a Goa in duties that we save is just under 2 billion rand a year. And about 50% of those benefits are spread between just six companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, a Goa doesn't really do that much for South Africa, but it is a very powerful political tool for the US. And, you know, I'm not suggesting the other big powers like China don't do similar things, but I think this doesn't help. I've argued for years that South Africa is better off having a trade agreement with the US where you've got some recourse if you're unhappy. But this idea that you could just pull a benefit because South Africa irritates you, I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah. So Donald, just come home now for a moment. Your clients are big industrialists, big traders. The country seems to be enjoying a sort of welcome moment of hope, I suppose, post the election. The rand's up, the markets are up, the cost of our debt's down, inflation's falling, so interest rates. Are your clients happy? Are they confident about the future?
Mostly, yes. I think to a degree, everybody is just relieved that the wheels haven't come off. I think despite the difficulties immediately after the election, we had a good election. It was free. It was fair. All of those things matter. The ANC didn't in any way attempt to kind of rig the election or hold on to power. So I think from that perspective, there's a sense of relief. And I think that's worth a significant amount. But I'm not sure on the really big issues that much has changed. We haven't put a dent in unemployment. Transnet is not miraculously working. But I think for the first time in a long while, there's some hope that it will work. And I think that's good. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is more sentiment than reality. But I'm hopeful that reality will follow.
Yeah. And you're a very focused watcher of South African industrial policy with all its attendant trade issues. How is the new trade, industry and competition minister at Parks Tower doing, in your view? Is he doing anything new, a lighter hand on tariffs? I see the government's now going to incentivize local retail. It's going to incentivize the retailing here of electric vehicles, which I don't think it was planning to do before the election. Seems to be some sort of a change.
Yeah, so I have requested a meeting with Minister Tau. His diary and mine are not lining up yet. But talking from the outside, I see a couple of fairly big changes. The one is the delays that we used to see, that report I put out twice a year looking at what is happening with these tariff decisions.
Yeah.
The shift there has just been nothing short of astonishing. So,
tell me, what's happened?
Well, it just decisions are being taken, and they've been taken within reasonable amounts of time. I mean, there's still a backlog that the new minister has to clear, but he's putting a dent into it. So this is good. You know, whether those decisions are good or bad, will be decided afterwards. Yeah, some people will go to court to dispute it, but at least the decisions are being taken. And I think that's incredibly well done to the minister and to ITAC for putting their shoulder to the wheel. So that's kind of probably, in my world, been a big improvement. I think a real, at least publicly stated, shift away from import replacement towards export focus. I've yet to see how that manifests, but the start of it is that you've got to talk about it. And there does appear to be a genuine sense that this is important. I think I wouldn't want to put the minister in a difficult position where he has to directly contradict his predecessor. But I think if this direction holds, and I'm hopeful it will, that would have an enormous impact on our economy if we can kind of shift away from raising the walls and sort of putting everyone in the lager. I think it'd be very good, and it would create a more competitive country.
Donald, where have you picked up these signals? Is the minister talking about exactly is he?
He is, and not just him, of course. Perhaps even more importantly, it's coming out of the bureaucracy. So, yes, the minister does mention it. I was at a dinner the other day where the minister was a keynote speaker, and he mentioned the importance of developing exports and being competitive. These are all things I've kind of been banging on about for years and years.
Absolutely,
we need a focus. Yeah. So I'm, whether that happens, I don't know. But I'm optimistic, Peter, which is all I seem to be saying on this podcast.
But fair enough. It's early days yet for things like industrial policy, because it's a big shift to make. And clearly we need to export more. That's where the money, that's where the profit is. That's where so all the economic gains that we would look for as a country are. And it's something that we can all get behind rather than split up industries into who's signed on to the master plan and who hasn't. Everybody can sign on to an export drive because it's such, it's a great national effort. It's like supporting the Springboks, I suppose. On steel, I just wanted to finish because you and I have had a lot of conversations about steel. He's also got some very hard calls to make on steel, doesn't he? I mean, he can't forever continue to protect AMSA, the old ISCOR. Which calls every time I read anything from them, it's asking for more and more protection. And I presume at some stage he's going to have to make a call about whether it's worth protecting AMSA, whether he eases up on import control so that steel becomes cheaper to people who want to use it in this country. And whether he allows the export of scrap to resume as vigorously as it once did,
Yeah, I mean that's always going to be a tough call to make. And I guess in the minister's mind, if AMSA does close, which I think is a real risk if the protection is removed, we're never going to have another steel mill. Nobody's going to come in and, in a hurry, set up another version of this. I guess the fear would be that we would lose it forever, and we would, that would have knock-on effects into things like the automotive industry. But on the other hand, the automotive industry itself sucks a huge amount of money out of the economy in the form of the automotive subsidies. But that would be on the one end. On the scrap metal, Peter, I'm in fact busy writing something at the moment about it. This has got to come to a head at some point. We've created a market on scrap metal, which somewhat ironically is contributing to the demise of ArcelorMittal. So, I would think if ArcelorMittal is struggling to compete against China, which they clearly are, and yet you have producers in South Africa who are receiving these enormous subsidies and are then selling their product in South Africa at the price that China does, which is sort of what is happening, then that is a problem. And the scrap metal sector is just I would argue, over-invested in by government. It is over-subsidized. It's far too protected. And the result is we now have so many companies in the space. We've got the IDC's exposure to these mini malls is almost 10 times the market capitalization of ArcelorMittal. They have more companies in business rescue in the mini mall sector than the whole value of ArcelorMittal. So it's a completely crazy situation. Two-thirds of their whole book at the IDC, which is currently in business rescue, are these mini malls. So, you know, even with all of this protection and all of these support mechanisms, we still have an industry which seems to be endlessly requiring more and more and more.
What's gone wrong? I mean, so what is the right call for him to make? Does he stop supporting, you know, the mini mills and ArcelorMittal, or does he simply allow them to get on with it within the constraints of a market, or the market forces that, whatever they may be? Obviously, you shouldn't be allowed to dump steel in this country. It's got to be produced at a reasonable, it's got to come into the country at a reasonable rate if it is going to come in. What's the right thing for him to do now? He's an ANC minister. He can't disregard the jobs effect. But you know, the jobs, particularly that I see at ArcelorMittal, are not just hanging by a thread. I mean, they're just, you know, they're so precarious, and it's such an untenable situation. It can't survive.
I think with the steel sector, Peter, we're almost unable to any longer find where the sort of equilibrium is between supply and demand, because everything is so distorted. So you have these huge subsidies to the mini mills. By the way, that works out to about 8.5 billion rand a year. We then collect another R1 billion in export duties. We have the cheap finance out of the IDC. And then on the other hand, you're trying to assist ArcelorMittal to compensate for the effect of your subsidies by giving them duties. Now, ArcelorMittal have just brought two anti-dumping applications, one on hot rolled steel and another on structural, and that will find its way through the system. And if there is dumping, duties will be applied, or if there's not, there won't be. But and I have no issue with that. I mean, they need to bring their case, and the companies on the other side need to defend it. And ITAC, generally does a good job, and they'll arrive at an outcome. That I'm fine with. But I think what you can't do is sort of protect one sector, subsidize it, be shocked when it then outperforms the other, and sort of try to then compensate by loading up the cost for the consumer on the other end. So I would recommend, if I was the minister, I would get rid of the export duty, because that benefits no one. The export duty on scrap, you only pay if nobody wants to buy it locally, because you can't export without that. So I would get rid of the export duty. It's a pointless thing, and that would immediately put around R1 billion a year back into the sector at almost no cost, really. And I would begin taking the more ludicrous rules out of the price preference system, the discount system that forces down the value of scrap. You've got just some crazy conditions which have been added there. For example, the seller of the scrap may not ask the buyer of the scrap to pay for transport. So if you're in Kimberley and you've got to get your load to Joburg, you have to cover the cost. So you've got the 30% discount to global price, but the further you are away from Gauteng, so your transport cost rises. One of the mini malls just the other day put out a note saying, when your truck drives over our weighbridge, if we find any problem with your material, we will charge you R1,000 per ton before we let you take your truck out. So you can quickly see the abuse that kind of gets embedded.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to disappear.
Okay, well, let's hope he does it. Donald Mackay, thank you so much. That's all we've got time for. Always great to talk to you. And thank you for listening. I hope you join me again soon for the next edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Stay safe. Bye-bye.